This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Side 1, The Stars Like Dust, by Isaac Asimov. Copyright 1950 and 1951 by World Editions Incorporated. Copyright 1951 by Isaac Asimov. Narrated by Hal Tenney. This book contains 192 pages on 6 sides. About the author. Isaac Asimov is regarded as one of the greatest science fiction writers of our time, as well as a valued contributor to the world of science. He holds a PhD in chemistry from Columbia University, 1948, and though he no longer lives in the Boston area, is an associate professor of biochemistry at Boston University. He has received numerous awards for his inspiring scientific articles covering a wide range of subjects. In this novel, Dr. Asimov's probing imagination has created a fascinating adventure set in the far distant future, an adventure that could change from fiction to fact any day now. Half a century before, the Nebula Kingdoms had been conquered by the cruel and domineering Tyranni, the warlords of Tyran. Now, Biren Farrell's father had disappeared, and Biren himself was marked for murder. He knew that his enemies were backed by the Tyranni, and that they were really responsible. But why had he and his father been singled out for destruction? The answer takes him through the cosmic reaches of the galaxies. It becomes a quest for the rebellion world, the hidden planet that shelters a conspiracy against the Tyranni and holds the only hope of peace for man's future. The quest is a dangerous one. The stakes are either the end of the Tyranni or the end of Biren Farrell. Other books by Isaac Asimov. The Early Asimov, Book 1. The Early Asimov, Book 2. Pebble in the Sky. The Currents of Space. The Caves of Steel. The End of Eternity. The Martian Way. The Naked Sun. Earth is Room Enough. 9 Tomorrows. Nightfall. The Gods Themselves. And these anthologies edited by Isaac Asimov. The Hugo Winners, Volume 1. Stories from the Hugo Winners, Volume 2. More Stories from the Hugo Winners, Volume 2. Where do we go from here? Chapter 1. The Bedroom Murmured. The bedroom murmured to itself gently. It was almost below the limits of hearing, an irregular little sound, yet quite unmistakable and quite deadly. But it wasn't that which awakened Biren Farrell and dragged him out of a heavy, unrefreshing slumber. He turned his head restlessly from side to side in a futile struggle against the periodic burr on the end table. He put out a clumsy hand without opening his eyes in closed contact. "Hello?" he mumbled. Sound tumbled instantly out of the receiver. It was harsh and loud, but Biren lacked the ambition to reduce the volume. It said, "May I speak to Biren Farrell?" Biren said fuzzily, "Speaking. What do you want?" "May I speak to Biren Farrell?" The voice was urgent. Biren's eyes opened on the thick darkness. He became conscious of the dry unpleasantness of his tongue and the faint odor that remained in the room. He said, "Speaking, who is this?" It went on, disregarding him, gathering tension, a loud voice in the night. "Is anyone there? I would like to speak to Biren Farrell." Biren raised himself on one elbow and stared at the place where the visiphone sat. He jabbed at the vision control, and the small screen was alive with light. "Here I am," he said. He recognized the smooth, slightly asymmetric features of Sandra Jonty. "Call me in the morning, Jonty." He started to turn the instrument off once more when Jonty said, "Hello? Hello? Is anyone there? Is this University Hall, room 526? Hello?" Biren was suddenly aware that the tiny pilot light, which would have indicated a live sending circuit, was not on. He swore under his breath and pushed the switch. It stayed off. Then Jonty gave up and the screen went blank and was merely a small square of featureless light. Biren turned it off. He hunched his shoulder and tried to burrow into the pillow again. He was annoyed. In the first place, no one had the right to yell at him in the middle of the night. He looked quickly at the gently luminous figures just over the headboard. 3:15. House lights wouldn't go on for nearly 4 hours. Besides, he didn't like having to wake to the complete darkness of his room. 4 years' custom had not hardened him to the Earthman's habit of building structures of reinforced concrete, squat, thick, and windowless. It was a thousand-year-old tradition, dating from the days when the primitive nuclear bomb had not yet been countered by the force field defense. But that was past. Atomic warfare had done its worst to Earth. Most of it was hopelessly radioactive and useless. There was nothing left to lose, and yet architecture mirrored the old fears, so that when Biren woke, it was to pure darkness. Biren rose on his elbow again. That was strange. He waited. It wasn't the fatal murmur of the bedroom he had become aware of. It was something perhaps even less noticeable, and certainly infinitely less deadly. He missed the gentle movement of air that one took so for granted, that trace of continuous renewal. He tried to swallow easily and failed. The atmosphere seemed to become oppressive even as he realized the situation. The ventilating system had stopped working, and now he really had a grievance. He couldn't even use the visiphone to report the matter. He tried again to make sure. The milky square of light sprang out and threw a faint pearly luster on the bed. It was receiving, but it wouldn't send. Well, it didn't matter. Nothing would be done about it before day, anyway. He yawned and groped for his slippers, rubbing his eyes with the heels of his palms. No ventilation, eh? That would account for the queer smell. He frowned and sniffed sharply 2 or 3 times. No use. It was familiar, but he couldn't place it. He made his way to the bathroom and reached automatically for the light switch, although he didn't really need it, to draw himself a glass of water. It closed, but uselessly. He tried it several times, peevishly. Wasn't anything working? He shrugged, drank in the dark, and felt better. He yawned again on his way back to the bedroom, where he tried the main switch. All the lights were out. Biren sat on the bed, placed his large hands on his hard-muscled thighs, and considered. Ordinarily, a thing like this would call for a terrific discussion with the service staff. No one expected hotel service in a college dormitory, but by space there were certain minimum standards of efficiency one could demand. Not that it was of vital importance just now. Graduation was coming, and he was through. In 3 days, he'd be saying a last goodbye to the room and to the University of Earth. To Earth itself, for that matter. Still, he might report it anyway, without particular comment. He could go out and use the hall phone. They might bring in a self-powered light, or even rig up a fan so he could sleep without psychosomatic choking sensations. If not, to space with him. 2 more nights. In the light of the useless visiphone, he located a pair of shorts. Over them he slipped a one-piece jumper, and decided that that would be enough for the purpose. He retained his slippers. There was no danger of waking anybody, even if he clumped down the corridors in spiked shoes, considering the thick, nearly soundproof partitions of this concrete pile. But he saw no point in changing. He strode toward the door and pulled at the lever. It descended smoothly, and he heard the click that meant the door release had been activated. Except that it wasn't. And although his biceps tightened into lumps, nothing was accomplished. He stepped away. This was ridiculous. Had there been a general power failure? There couldn't have been. The clock was going. The visiphone was still receiving properly. Wait. It could have been the boys, bless their erratic souls. It was done sometimes. Infantile, of course, but he'd taken part in these foolish practical jokes himself. It wouldn't have been difficult, for instance, for one of his buddies to sneak in during the day and arrange matters. But no. The ventilation and lights were working when he'd gone to sleep. Very well, then, during the night. The hall was an old, outmoded structure. It wouldn't have taken an engineering genius to hocus the lighting and ventilation circuits, or to jam the door, either. And now they would wait for morning and see what would happen when good old Biron found he couldn't get out. They would probably let him out toward noon and laugh very hard. "Ha, ha," said Biron grimly under his breath. All right, if that's the way it was. But he would have to do something about it, turn the tables some way. He turned away and his toe kicked something which skidded metallically across the floor. He could barely make out its shadow moving through the dim visiphone light. He reached under the bed, patting the floor in a wide arc. He brought it out and held it close to the light. They weren't so smart. They should have put the visiphone entirely out of commission, instead of just yanking out the sending circuit. He found himself holding a small cylinder with a little hole in the blister on top. He put it close to his nose and sniffed at it. That explained the smell in the room, anyway. It was hypnite. Of course, the boys would have had to use it to keep him from waking up while they were busy with the circuits. Biron could reconstruct the proceedings step by step now. The door was jimmied open, a simple thing to do, and the only dangerous part, since he might have wakened then. The door might have been prepared during the day, for that matter, so that it would seem to close and not actually do so. He hadn't tested it. Anyway, once open, a can of hypnite would be put just inside, and the door would be closed again. The anesthetic would leak out slowly, building up to the 1 in 10,000 concentration necessary to put him definitely under. Then they could enter, masked, of course. Space, a wet handkerchief would keep out the hypnite for 15 minutes, and that would be all the time needed. It explained the ventilation system situation. That had to be eliminated to keep the hypnite from dispersing too quickly. That would have gone first, in fact. The visiphone elimination kept him from getting help. The door jamming kept him from getting out. And the absence of lights induced panic. Nice kids. Biron snorted. It was socially impossible to be thin-skinned about this. A joke was a joke and all that. Right now, he would have liked to break the door down and have done with it. The well-trained muscles of his torso tensed at the thought, but it would be useless. The door had been built with atom blasts in mind. Damn that tradition. But there had to be some way out. He couldn't let them get away with it. First, he would need a light, a real one, not the immovable and unsatisfactory glow of the visiphone. That was no problem. He had a self-powered flashlight in the clothes closet. For a moment, as he fingered the closet door controls, he wondered if they had jammed that, too. But it moved open, naturally, and slid smoothly into its wall socket. Biron nodded to himself. It made sense. There was no reason, particularly, to jam the closet, and they didn't have too much time, anyway. And then, with the flashlight in his hand, as he was turning away, the entire structure of his theory collapsed in a horrible instant. He stiffened, his abdomen ridging with tension, and held his breath listening. For the first time since awakening, he heard the murmuring of the bedroom. He heard the quiet, irregular, chuckling conversation it was holding with itself, and recognized the nature of the sound at once. It was impossible not to recognize it. The sound was Earth's death rattle. It was the sound that had been invented 1,000 years before. To be exact, it was the sound of a radiation counter, ticking off the charged particles and the hard gamma waves that came its way. The soft, clicking electronic surges melting into a low murmur. It was the sound of a counter, counting the only thing it could count, death. Softly, on tiptoe, Biron backed away. From a distance of 6 feet, he threw the white beam into the recesses of the closet. The counter was there, in the far corner, but seeing it told him nothing. It had been there ever since his freshman days. Most freshmen from the outer worlds bought a counter during their first week on Earth. They were very conscious of Earth's radioactivity then, and felt the need of protection. Usually, they were sold again to the next class, but Biren had never disposed of his. He was thankful for that now. He turned to the desk, where he kept his wristwatch while sleeping. It was there. His hand was shaking a little as he held it up to the flashlight's beam. The watch strap was an interwoven, flexible plastic of an almost liquidly smooth whiteness, and it was white. He held it away and tried it at different angles. It was white. That strap had been another freshman purchase. Hard radiation turned it blue, and blue on Earth was the color of death. It was easy to wander into a path of radiating soil during the day if you were lost or careless. The government fenced off as many patches as it could, and of course no one ever approached the huge areas of death that began several miles outside the city. But the strap was insurance. If it should ever turn a faint blue, you would show up at the hospital for treatment. There was no argument about it. The compound of which it was made was precisely as sensitive to radiation as you were, and appropriate photoelectric instruments could be used to measure the intensity of the blueness so that the seriousness of the case might be determined quickly. A bright royal blue was the finish. Just as the color would never change back, neither would you. There was no cure, no chance, no hope. You just waited anywhere from a day to a week, and all the hospital could do was to make final arrangements for cremation. But at least it was still white, and some of the clamor in Biren's thoughts subsided. There wasn't much radioactivity then. Could it be just another angle of the joke? Biren considered and decided that it couldn't. Nobody would do that to anyone else. Not on Earth, anyway, where illegal handling of radioactive material was a capital offense. They took radioactivity seriously here on Earth. They had to. So nobody would do this without overpowering reason. He stated the thought to himself carefully and explicitly, facing it boldly. The overpowering reason, for instance, of a desire to murder. But why? There could be no motive. In his 23 years of life, he had never made a serious enemy, not this serious, not murder serious. He clutched at his clipped hair. This was a ridiculous line of thought, but there was no escaping it. He stepped cautiously back to the closet. There had to be something there that was sending out radiation, something that had not been there 4 hours earlier. He saw it almost at once. It was a little box, not more than 6 inches in any direction. Biren recognized it, and his lower lip trembled slightly. He had never seen one before, but he had heard of them. He lifted the counter and took it into the bedroom. The little murmur fell off, almost ceased. It started again when the thin mica partition, through which the radiation entered, pointed toward the box. There was no question in his mind. It was a radiation bomb. The present radiations were not in themselves deadly. They were only a fuse. Somewhere inside the box, a tiny atomic pile was constructed. Short-lived artificial isotopes heated it slowly, permeating it with the appropriate particles. When the threshold of head and particle density was reached, the pile reacted. Not in an explosion, usually, although the heat of reaction would serve to fuse the box itself into a twist of metal, but in a tremendous burst of deadly radiation that would kill anything living within a radius of 6 feet to 6 miles, depending on the bomb's size. There was no way of telling when the threshold would be reached. Perhaps not for hours, and perhaps the next moment. Biren remained standing helplessly, flashlight held loosely in his damp hands. Half an hour before, the visiphone had awakened him, and he had been at peace then. Now he knew he was going to die. Biren didn't want to die, but he was penned in hopelessly, and there was no place to hide. He knew the geography of the room. It was at the end of a corridor, so that there was another room only on one side, and of course above and below. He could do nothing about the room above. The room on the same floor was on the bathroom side, and it adjoined via its own bathroom. He doubted that he could make himself heard. That left the room below. There were a couple of folding chairs in the room, spare seats to accommodate company. He took one. It made a flat, slapping sound when it hit the floor. He turned it edgewise, and the sound became harder and louder. Between each blow, he waited, wondering if he could rouse the sleeper below and annoy him sufficiently to have him report the disturbance. Abruptly, he caught a faint noise and paused, the splintering chair raised above his head. The noise came again like a faint shout. It was from the direction of the door. He dropped the chair and yelled in return. He crushed his ear up against the crack where door joined wall, but the fit was good, and the sound, even there, was dim. But he could make out his own name being called. "Farrell! Farrell!" several times over, and something else. Maybe, "Are you in there?" or "Are you all right?" He roared back, "Get the door open!" He shouted it three or four times. He was in a feverish sweat of impatience. The bomb might be on the point of letting loose even now. He thought they heard him. At least the muffled cry came back, "Watch out! Something, something, blaster!" He knew what they meant and backed hurriedly away from the door. There were a couple of sharp cracking sounds, and he could actually feel the vibrations set up in the air of the room. Then there followed a splitting noise, and the door was flung inward. Light poured in from the corridor. Biren dashed out, arms flung wide. "Don't come in," he yelled. "For the love of Earth, don't come in. There's a radiation bomb in there." He was facing two men. One was Jonty. The other was Espak, the superintendent. He was only partly dressed. "A radiation bomb?" he stuttered. But Jonty said, "What size?" Jonty's blaster was still in his hand, and that alone jarred with the dandyish effect of his ensemble, even at this time of night. Biren could only gesture with his hands. "All right," said Jonty. He seemed quite cool about it as he turned to the superintendent. "You'd better evacuate the rooms in this area, and if you have lead sheets anywhere on the university grounds, have them brought out here to line the corridor, and I wouldn't let anyone in there before morning." He turned to Biren. "It probably has a 12 to 18 foot radius. How did it get there?" "I don't know," said Biren. He wiped his forehead with the back of his hand. "If you don't mind, I've got to sit down somewhere." He threw a glance at his wrist, then realized his wristwatch was still in the room. He had a wild impulse to return after it. There was action now. Students were being hustled out of their rooms. "Come with me," said Jonty. "I think you'd better sit down, too." Biren said, "What brought you out to my room? Not that I'm not thankful, you understand. I called you. There was no answer, and I had to see you." "To see me?" He spoke carefully, trying to control his irregular breathing. "Why?" "To warn you that your life was in danger." Biren laughed raggedly. "I found out." "That was only the first attempt. They'll try again." "Who are they?" "Not here, Farrow," said Jonty. "We need privacy for this. You're a marked man, and I may already have endangered myself as well." Chapter 2, The Net Across Space. The student lounge was empty. It was dark as well. At 4:30 in the morning, it could scarcely have been otherwise. Yet Jonty hesitated a moment as he held the door open, listening for occupants. "No," he said softly. "Leave the lights out. We won't need them to talk." "I've had enough of the dark for one night," muttered Biren. "We'll leave the door ajar." Biren lacked the will to argue. He dropped into the nearest chair and watched the rectangle of light through the closing door narrow down to a thin line. Now that it was all over, he was getting the shakes. Jonty steadied the door and rested his little swagger stick upon the crack of light on the floor. "Watch it. It will tell us if anyone passes, or if the door moves." Biren said, "Please, I'm not in a conspiratorial mood. If you don't mind, I'd appreciate your telling me whatever it is you want to tell me. You've saved my life, I know, And tomorrow I'll be properly thankful. Right now I could do with a short drink and a long rest. I can imagine your feelings, Johnny said. But the too long rest you might have had has been avoided momentarily. I would like to make it more than just momentarily. Do you know that I know your father? The question was an abrupt one, and Biren raised his eyebrows, a gesture lost in the dark. He said, he's never mentioned knowing you. I would be surprised if he did. He doesn't know me by the name I use here. Have you heard from your father recently, by the way? Why do you ask? Because he's in great danger. What? Jonty's hand found the other's arm in the dimness and gripped it firmly. Please, keep your voice as it has been. Biren realized for the first time that they had been whispering. Jonty resumed. I'll be more specific. Your father has been taken into custody. You understand the significance? No, I certainly don't understand. Who has taken him into custody? What are you getting at? Why are you bothering me? Biren's temples were throbbing. The hypnite and the near death had made it impossible to fence with the cool dandy sitting so close to him that his whispers were as plain as shouts. Surely, came the whisper, you have some inkling of the work your father is doing. If you know my father, you know he is rancher of Widimus. That is his work, Jonty said. Well, there is no reason you should trust me, other than that I am risking my own life for you. But I already know all that you can tell me. As an example, I know that your father has been conspiring against the Tyranni. I deny that, said Biren tensely. Your service to me this night does not give you the right to make such statements about my father. You are foolishly evasive, young man, and you are wasting my time. Don't you see that the situation is beyond verbal fencing? I'll say it outright. Your father is in the custody of the Tyranni. He may be dead by now. I don't believe you, Biren half rose. I am in a position to know. Let's break this off, Jonty. I am in no mood for mystery, and I resent this attempt of yours to... Well, to what? Jonty's voice lost some of its refined edge. What do I gain by telling you this? May I remind you that this knowledge of mine, which you will not accept, made it plain to me that an attempt might be made to kill you. Judge by what has happened, Pharaoh. Biren said, start again and tell us straight. I'll listen. Very well. I imagine, Pharaoh, that you know me to be a fellow countryman from the Nebula Kingdoms, although I've been passing myself off as a Vegan. I judge that might be a possibility by your accent. It didn't seem important. It's important, my friend. I came here because, like your father, I didn't like the Tyranni. They've been oppressing our people for 50 years. That's a long time. I'm not a politician. Again, Jonty's voice had an irritated edge to it. Oh, I'm not one of their agents trying to get you into trouble. I'm telling you the truth. They caught me a year ago, as they've caught your father now. But I managed to get away and came to Earth, where I thought I might be safe until I was ready to return. That's all I need to tell you about myself. It is more than I have asked for, sir. Biren could not force the unfriendliness out of his voice. Jonty affected him unfavorably with his too precise mannerisms. I know that. But it is necessary to tell you so much, at least. For it was in this manner that I met your father. He worked with me, or rather, I with him. He knew me, but not in his official capacity, as the greatest nobleman on the planet of Nephilus. You understand me? Biren nodded uselessly in the darkness and said, yes. It is not necessary to go into that further. My sources of information have been maintained even here. And I know that he has been imprisoned. It is knowledge. If it were merely suspicion, this attempt on your life would have been sufficient proof. In what way? If the Tyranni have the father, would they leave the son at large? Are you trying to tell me that the Tyranni set that radiation bomb in my room?
That's impossible. Why is it impossible? Can't you understand their position? The Tyranni rule 50 worlds. They are outnumbered hundreds to one. In such a position, simple force is insufficient. Devious methods, intrigue, assassination are their specialties. The net they weave across space is a wide one and close-meshed. I can well believe that it extends across 500 light-years to Earth. Biron was still in the grip of his nightmare. In the distance, there were the faint sounds of the lead shields being moved into place. In his room, the counter must still be murmuring. He said, "It doesn't make sense. I'm going back to Nephilus this week. They would know that. Why should they kill me here? If they'd wait, they'd have me." He was relieved to find the flaw, eager to believe his own logic. Jonty leaned closer, and his spiced breath stirred the hairs on Biron's temple. "Your father is popular. His death, and once imprisoned by the Tyranni, his execution becomes a probability you must face. Would be resented even by the cowed slave race the Tyranni are trying to breed. You could rally that resentment as the new rancher of Widimus, and to execute you as well would double the danger for them. To make martyrs is not their purpose. But if you were to die in a faraway world by accident, it would be convenient for them." "I don't believe you," said Biron. It had become his only defense. Jonty rose, adjusting his thin gloves. He said, "You go too far, Pharaoh. Your role would be more convincing if you pretended to know such complete ignorance. Your father has been shielding you from reality for your own protection, presumably. Yet I doubt that you could remain completely uninfluenced by his beliefs. Your hate for the Tyranni cannot help being a reflection of his own. You cannot help being ready to fight them." Biron shrugged. Jonty said, "He may even recognize your new adulthood to the point of putting you to use. You are conveniently here on Earth, and it is not unlikely you may be combining your education with a definite assignment. An assignment, perhaps, for the failure of which the Tyranni are ready to kill you." "That's silly melodrama, is it? Let it be so, then. If the truth will not persuade you now, events will later. There will be other attempts on your life, and the next one will succeed. From this moment on, Farrell, you are a dead man." Biron looked up. "Wait. What's your own private interest in the matter?" "I'm a patriot. I would like to see the kingdoms free again, with governments of their own choosing." "No. Your private interest. I cannot accept idealism only, because I won't believe it of you. I'm sorry if that offends you." Biron's words pounded doggedly. Jonty seated himself again. He said, "My lands have been confiscated. Before my exile, it was not comfortable to be forced to take orders from those dwarfs. And since then, it has become more imperative than ever to become once again the man my grandfather had been before the Tyranni came. Is that enough of a practical reason for wanting a revolution? Your father would have been a leader of that revolution. Failing him, you. I am 23 and know nothing of all this. You could find better men." "Undoubtedly I could. But no one else is the son of your father. If your father is killed, you will be rancher of Widimus, and as such it would be valuable to me if you were only 12, and an idiot besides. I need you for the same reason that Tyranni must be rid of you. And if my necessity is unconvincing to you, surely theirs cannot be. There was a radiation bomb in your room. It could only have been meant to kill you. Who else would want to kill you?" Jonty waited patiently and picked up the other's whisper. "No one," said Biron. "No one would want to kill me that I know of. And it's true about my father." "It is true. View it as a casualty of war." "You think that would make it better? They'll put up a monument to him someday, perhaps? One with a radiating inscription that you can see 10,000 miles out in space?" His voice was becoming a bit ragged. Is that supposed to make me happy? Jonty waited, but Viren said nothing more. Jonty said, What do you intend doing? I'm going home. You still don't understand your position, then? I said, I'm going home. What do you want me to do? If he's alive, I'll get him out of there. And if he's dead, I'll...
Quiet.
The older man's voice was coldly annoyed. You rave like a child. You can't go to Nephilis. Don't you see that you can't? Am I talking to an infant or to a young man of sense? Viren muttered. What do you suggest? Do you know the director of Rhodia? The friend of the Tyranni? I know the man. I know who he is. Everyone in the kingdoms knows who he is. Henrik V, director of Rhodia. Have you ever met him?
No.
That is what I meant. If you haven't met him, you don't know him. He is an imbecile, Tharo. I mean it literally. But when the Ranchi of Widimus is confiscated by the Tyranni, and it will be, as my lands were, it will be awarded to Henrik. There the Tyranni will feel them to be safe, and there you must go. Why? Because Henrik, at least, has influence with the Tyranni, as much influence as a lickspittle puppet may have. He may arrange to have you reinstated. I don't see why. He's more likely to turn me over to them.
So he is.
But you'll be on your guard against it, and there is a fighting chance you may avoid it. Remember, the title you carry is valuable and important, but it is not all-sufficient. In this business of conspiracy, one must be practical above all. Men will rally about you out of sentiment and respect for your name, but to hold them, you will need money. Viren considered. I need time to decide. You have no time. Your time ran out when the radiation bomb was planted in your room. Let us take action. I can give you a letter of introduction to Henrik of Rhodia. You know him so well, then? Your suspicion never sleeps very soundly, does it? I once headed a mission to Henrik's court on behalf of the Autarch of Lingani. His imbecile's mind will probably not remember me, but he will not dare to show he is forgotten. It will serve as an introduction, and you can improvise from there. I will have the letter for you in the morning. There is a ship leaving for Rhodia at noon. I have tickets for you. I am leaving myself by another route. Don't linger. You're all through here, aren't you? There is the diploma presentation. A scrap of parchment. Does it matter to you?
Not now.
Do you have money?
Enough.
Very well. Too much would be suspicious. He spoke sharply. Pharaoh. Viren stirred out of what was nearly a stupor.
What?
Get back to the others. Tell no one you are leaving. Let the act speak.
Viren nodded dumbly. Far away in the recesses of his mind, there was the thought that his mission remained unaccomplished, and that in this way, too, he failed his dying father. He was racked with a futile bitterness. He might have been told more. He might have shared the dangers. He should not have been allowed to act in ignorance. And now that he knew the truth, or at least more of it, concerning the extent of his father's role in conspiracy, there was an added importance to the document he was to have obtained from Earth's archives. But there was no time any longer. No time to get the document. No time to wonder about it. No time to save his father. No time, perhaps, to live. He said, I'll do as you say, Jonty. Sander Jonty looked briefly out over the university campus as he paused on the steps of the dormitory. Certainly there was no admiration in his glance. As he stepped down the bricked walk that wound unsubtly through the pseudo-rustic atmosphere affected by all urban campuses since antiquity, he could see the lights of the city's single important street gleam just ahead. Past it, drowned in daytime but visible now, was the eternal radioactive blue of the horizon, mute witness of prehistoric wars.
Jaunty considered the sky for a moment. Over 50 years had passed since the Tirani had come and put a sudden end to the separate lives of 24 sprawling, brawling political units in the depths beyond the nebula. Now, suddenly and prematurely, the peace of strangulation lay upon them. The storm that had caught them in one vast thunderclap had been something from which they had not yet recovered. It had left only a sort of twitching that futilely agitated a world here and there, now and then. To organize those twitchings, to align them into a single well-timed heave, would be a difficult task and a long one. Well, he had been rusticating here on Earth long enough. It was time to go back. The others, back home, were probably trying to get in touch with him at his rooms right now. He lengthened his stride a bit. He caught the beam as he entered his room. It was a personal beam, for whose security there were as yet no fears, and in whose privacy there was no chink. No formal receiver was required, no thing of metal and wires to catch the faint drifting surges of electrons, with their whispered impulses swimming through hyperspace from a world 6,000 light-years away. Space itself was polarized in his room and prepared for reception. Its fabric was smoothed out of randomness. There was no way of detecting that polarization except by receiving. And in that particular volume of space, only his own mind could act as receiver, since only the electrical characteristics of his own particular nerve cell system could resonate to the vibrations of the carrier beam that bore the message. The message was as private as the unique characteristics of his own brainwaves. And in all the universe, with its quadrillions of human beings, the odds against a duplication sufficiently close to allow one man to pick up another's personal wave was a 20-figured number to one. Jaunty's brain tickled to the call as it whined through the endless, empty incomprehensibility of hyperspace. Calling, 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 calling. Sending was not quite so simple a job as receiving. A mechanical contrivance was needed to set up the highly specific carrier wave that would carry back to the contact beyond the nebula. That was contained in the ornamental button that he carried on his right shoulder. It was automatically activated when he stepped into his volume of space polarization. And after that, he had only to think purposefully and with concentration. Here I am. No need for more specific identification. The dull repetition of the calling signal halted and became words that took form within his mind. We greet you, sir. Widimus has been executed. The news is, of course, not yet public. It does not surprise me. Was anyone else implicated? No, sir. The rancher made no statements at any time. A brave and loyal man. Yes, but it takes more than simply bravery and loyalty. Or he would not have been caught. A little more cowardice might have been useful. No matter. I have spoken to his son, the new rancher, who has already had his brush with death. He will be put to use. May one inquire in what manner, sir? It is better to let events answer your question. Certainly I cannot foretell consequences of this early date. Tomorrow he will set off to see Henrik of Rodia. Henrik? The young man will run a fearful risk. Is he aware that I have told him as much as I can? Responded Jaunty sharply. We cannot trust him too far until he has proved himself. Under the circumstances as they exist, we can only view him as a man to be risked, like any other man. He is expendable, quite expendable. Do not call me here again, as I am leaving Earth. And with a gesture of finality, Jaunty broke the connection mentally. Quietly and thoughtfully, he went over the events of the day and the night, weighing each event. Slowly, he smiled. Everything had been arranged perfectly, and the comedy might now play itself out. Nothing had been left to chance. Chapter 3, Chance and the Wristwatch. The first hour of a spaceship's rise from planetary thraldom is the most prosaic. There is the confusion of departure, which is much the same in essence as that which must have accompanied the shoving off of the first hollowed-out tree trunk on some primeval river. You have your accommodations. Your luggage is taken care of. There is the first stiff moment of strangeness and meaningless hustle surrounding you. The shouted last-moment intimacies, the quieting, the muted clang of the airlocks, followed by the slow soughing of air as the locks screw inward automatically, like gigantic drills becoming airtight. Then the portentous silence and the red signs flicking in every room. Adjust acceleration suits, adjust acceleration suits, adjust acceleration suits. The stewards scour the corridors, knocking shortly on each door and jerking it open. Big pardon, suits on. You battle with the suits, cold, tight, uncomfortable, but cradled in a hydraulic system which absorbs the sickening pressures of the takeoff. There is the faraway rumble of the atom-driven motors on low power for atmospheric maneuvering, followed instantly by the giving back against the slow-yielding oil of the suit cradle. You recede almost indefinitely back, then very slowly forward again, as the acceleration decreases. If you survive nausea during this period, you are probably safe from space sickness for duration. The view room was not open to the passengers for the first 3 hours of the flight, and there was a long line waiting when the atmosphere had been left behind and the double doors were ready to separate. There were present not only the usual 100% turnout of all planetaries, those in other words who had never been in space before, but a fair proportion of the more experienced travelers as well. The vision of Earth from space, after all, was one of the tourist musts. The view room was a bubble on the ship's skin, a bubble of curved 2-foot-thick, steel-hard, transparent plastic. The retractable iridium steel lid, which protected it against the scouring of the atmosphere and its dust particles, had been sucked back. The lights were out, and the gallery was full. The faces peering over the bars were clear in the earthshine. For Earth was suspended there below, a gigantic and gleaming orange and blue and white patched balloon. The hemisphere showing was almost entirely sunlit. The continents between the clouds, a desert orange with thin scattered lines of green. The seas were blue, standing out sharply against the black of space where they met the horizon. And all around in the black, undusted sky were the stars. They waited patiently, those who watched. It was not the sunlit hemisphere they wanted. The polar cap, blinding bright, was shifting down into view as the ship maintained the slight, unnoticed sidewise acceleration that was lifting it out of the ecliptic. Slowly the shadow of night encroached upon the globe, and the huge world island of Eurasia, Africa, majestically took the stage, north side down. Its diseased, unliving soil hid its horror under a night-induced play of jewels. The radioactivity of the soil was a vast sea of iridescent blue, sparkling in strange festoons that spelled out the manner in which the nuclear bombs had once landed. A full generation before the force field defense against nuclear explosions had been developed, so that no other world could commit suicide in just that fashion again. The eyes watched, until with the hours, Earth was a bright little half-coin in the endless black. Among the watchers was Biren Farrell. He sat by himself in the front row, arms upon the railing, eyes brooding and thoughtful. This was not the way he had expected to leave Earth. It was the wrong manner, the wrong ship, the wrong destination. His tanned forearm rubbed against the stubble of his chin, and he felt guilty about not having shaved that morning. He'd go back to his room after a while and correct that. Meanwhile, he hesitated to leave. There were people here. In his room, he would be alone. Or was that just the reason he should leave?
He did not like the new feeling he had, that of being hunted, that of being friendless. All friendship had dropped from him. It had shriveled from the very moment he had been awakened by the phone call less than 24 hours earlier. Even in the dormitory, he had become an embarrassment. Old Esbach had pounced upon him when he had returned after his talk with Jati in the student lounge. Esbach was in turmoil, his voice overshrill.
"Mr. Farrell, I've been looking for you. It has been a most unfortunate incident. I can't understand it. Do you have any explanation?"
"No," he half shouted. "I don't. When can I get into my room and get my stuff out?"
"In the morning, I am sure. We've just managed to get the equipment up here to test the room. There is no longer any trace of radioactivity above normal background level. It was a very fortunate escape for you. Must have missed you only by minutes."
"Yes, yes, but if you don't mind, I would like to rest. Please use my room till morning, and then we'll get you relocated for the few days remaining you. By the way, Mr. Farrell, if you don't mind, there is another matter."
He was being overly polite. Biren could almost hear the eggshells give slightly beneath his finicky feet.
"What other matter?" asked Biren wearily. "Do you know of anyone who might have been interested in hazing you?"
"Hazing me like this?
Of course not."
"What are your plans, then? The school authorities would, of course, be most unhappy to have publicity arise as a result of this incident."
How he kept referring to it as an incident.
Biren said dryly, "I understand you, but don't worry. I'm not interested in investigations or in the police. I'm leaving Earth soon, and I'd just as soon not have my own plans disrupted. I'm not bringing any charges. After all, I'm still alive." Esbach had been almost indecently relieved. It was all they wanted from him. No unpleasantness. It was just an incident to be forgotten. He got into his old room again at 7 in the morning. It was quiet, and there was no murmuring in the closet. The bomb was no longer there, nor was the counter. They had probably been taken away by Esbach and thrown into the lake. It came under the head of destroying evidence, but that was the school's worry. He threw his belongings into suitcases and then called the desk for assignment to another room. The lights were working again, he noticed, and so, of course, was the visiphone. The one remnant of last night was the twisted door. Its lock melted away. They gave him another room. That established his intention to stay for anyone that might be listening. Then, using the hall phone, he had called an air cab. He did not think anyone saw him. Let the school puzzle out his disappearance however they pleased. For a moment, he had caught sight of Jonty at the spaceport. They met in the fashion of a glancing blow. Jonty said nothing, gave no sign of recognition. But after he had passed by, there were in Biren's hand a featureless little black globe that was a personal capsule, and a ticket for passage to Rhodia. He spent a moment upon the personal capsule. It was not sealed. He read the message later in his room. It was a simple introduction with minimum wordage. Biren's thoughts rested for a while upon Sander Jonty as he watched Earth shrivel with time there in the view room. He had known the man very superficially until Jonty had whirled so devastatingly into his life, first to save it, then to set it upon a new and untried course. Biren had known his name. He had nodded when they passed, had exchanged polite formalities occasionally, but that was all. He had not liked the man, had not liked his coldness, his overdressed, overmannered personality. But all that had nothing to do with affairs now. Biren rubbed his crew cut with a restless hand and sighed. He actually found himself hungering for Jonty's presence. The man was at least master of events. He had known what to do. He had known what Biren was to do. He had made Biren do it. And now Biren was alone and feeling very young, very helpless, very friendless, and almost frightened. Through it all, he studiously avoided thinking of his father. It would not help. "Mr. Mullane." The name was repeated two or three times before Biren started at the respectful touch upon his shoulder and looked up.
The robot messenger said again, "Mr. Mullane?" And for 5 seconds, Biren stared blankly, until he remembered that that was his temporary name. It had been penciled lightly upon the ticket which Jotty had given him. A stateroom had been reserved in that name.
"Yes? What is it? I am Mullane."
The messenger's voice hissed very faintly as the spool within whirled off its message. "I have been asked to inform you that your stateroom has been changed and that your baggage has already been shifted. If you'll see the purser, you will be given your new key. We trust that this will cause no inconvenience for you." "What's all this?" Biren whirled in his seat, and several of the thinning group of passengers still watching looked up at the explosive sound. "What's the idea?" Of course, it was no use arguing with a machine that had merely fulfilled its function. The messenger had bowed its metal head respectfully. Its gently fixed imitation of a human smile of ingratiation, unchanging, and had left. Biren strode out of the view room and accosted the ship's officer at the door with somewhat more energy than he had planned. "Look here, I want to see the captain." The officer showed no surprise.
"Is it important, sir?"
"It sure as space is. I've just had my stateroom shifted without my permission, and I'd like to know the meaning of it." Even at the time, Biren felt his anger to be out of proportion to the cause, but it represented an accumulation of resentment. He had nearly been killed. He had been forced to leave Earth like a skulking criminal. He was going he knew not where to do he knew not what. And now they were pushing him around aboard ship. It was the end. Yet through it all, he had the uncomfortable feeling that Jonty, in his shoes, would have acted differently, perhaps more wisely. Well, he wasn't Jotty. The officer said, "I will call the purser." "I want the captain," insisted Biren. "If you wish, then." And after a short conversation through the small ship's communicator suspended from his lapel, he said urbanely, "You will be called for. Please wait." Captain Herm Gordell was a rather short and thick-set man who rose politely and leaned over his desk to shake hands with Biren when the latter entered.
"Mr. Mullane," he said, "I am sorry we had to trouble you."
He had a rectangular face, iron-gray hair, a short, well-kept mustache of slightly darker hue, and a clipped smile.
"So am I," said Biren. "I had a stateroom reservation to which I was entitled, and I feel that not even you, sir, had the right to change it without my permission."
"Granted, Mr. Mullane, but you understand it was rather an emergency. A last-minute arrival, an important man, insisted on being moved to a stateroom close to the gravitational center of the ship. He had a heart condition, and it was important to keep ship's gravity as low as possible for him. We had no choice."
"All right, but why pick on me as the one to be shifted?
It had to be someone. You were traveling alone. You are a young man who we felt would have no difficulty in taking a slightly higher gravity."
His eyes traveled automatically up and down Biren's 6'2" of hard musculature.
"Besides, you will find your new room rather more elaborate than your old one. You've not lost by the exchange."
"No, indeed."
The captain stepped from behind his desk.
"May I show you your new quarters personally?"
Biren found it difficult to maintain his resentment. It seemed reasonable, this whole matter, and then again, not reasonable either. The captain was saying as they left his quarters,
"May I have your company at my table for tomorrow night's dinner? Our first jump is scheduled for that time."
Biren heard himself saying, "Thank you, I will be honored." Yet he thought the invitation strange. Granted that the captain was merely trying to soothe him, yet surely the method was stronger than necessary. The captain's table was a long one, taking up an entire wall of the salon. Biren found himself near the center, taking an unsuitable precedence over others. Yet there was his place card before him. The steward had been quite firm. There was no mistake. Biren was not particularly overmodest. As son of the rancher of Widimus, there had never been any necessity for the development of any such characteristic. And yet, as Biren Mullane, he was quite an ordinary citizen, and these things ought not to happen to ordinary citizens. For one thing, The captain had been perfectly correct about his new stateroom. It was more elaborate. His original room had been what his ticket called for, a single second class, while the replacement was a double room first. There was a bathroom adjoining, private of course, equipped with a stalled shower and an air dryer. It was near officers' country, and the presence of uniforms was almost overpowering. Lunch had been brought to his room on silver service. A barber made a sudden appearance just before dinner. All this was perhaps to be expected when one traveled on a luxury space liner, first class. But it was too good for Biren Mullane. It was far too good, for by the time the barber had arrived, Biren had just returned from an afternoon walk that had taken him through the corridors in a purposely devious path. There had been crewmen in his path wherever he had turned, polite, clinging. He shook them free somehow and reached 140D, his first room, the one he had never slept in. He stopped to light a cigarette, and in the interval spent thus, the only passenger in sight turned a corridor. Biren touched the signal light briefly, and there was no answer. Well, the old key had not been taken from him yet. An oversight, no doubt. He placed the thin oblong sliver of metal into its orifice, and the unique pattern of leaden opacity within the aluminum sheath activated the tiny phototube. The door opened, and he took one step inside. It was all he needed. He left, and the door closed automatically behind him. He had learned one thing immediately. His old room was not occupied, neither by an important personage with a weak heart, nor by anyone else. The bed and furnishings were too neat. No trunks, no toilet articles were in sight. The very air of occupancy was missing. So the luxury they were surrounding him with served only to prevent his taking further action to get back his original room. They were bribing him to stay quietly out of the old room. Why? Was it the room they were interested in, or was it himself? And now he sat at the captain's table with the questions unanswered, and rose politely with the rest as the captain entered, strode up the steps of the dais on which the long table was set, and took his place. Why had they moved him? There was music in the ship, and the walls that separated the salon from the view room had been retracted. The lights were low and tinged with orange-red. The worst of such space sickness as there might have been after the original acceleration, or as the result of first exposure to the minor gravity variations between various parts of the ship, had passed by now. The salon was full. The captain leaned forward slightly and said to Biren, "Good evening, Mr. Mullane. How do you find your new room?" "Almost too satisfactory, sir. A little rich for my way of life." He said it in a flat monotone, and it seemed to him that a faint dismay passed momentarily over the captain's face. Over the dessert, the skin of the view room's glass bubble slid smoothly back into its socket, and the lights dimmed to nearly nothing. Neither sun, earth, nor any planet was in view on that large dark screen. They were facing the Milky Way, that long-wise view of the galactic lens, and it made a luminous diagonal track among the hard, bright stars. Automatically, the tide of conversation ebbed. Chairs shifted, so that all faced the stars. The dinner guests had become an audience, the music a faint whisper. The voice over the amplifiers was clear and well-balanced in the gathered quiet. "Ladies, gentlemen, we are ready for our first jump. Most of you, I suppose, know at least theoretically what a jump is. Many of you, however, more than half, in point of fact, have never experienced one. It is to those last I would like to speak in particular. The jump is exactly what the name implies. In the fabric of space-time itself, it is impossible to travel faster than the speed of light. That is a natural law, first discovered by one of the ancients, the traditional Einstein, perhaps, except that so many things are credited to him. Even at the speed of light, of course, it would take years in resting time to reach the stars. Therefore, one leaves the space-time fabric to enter the little-known realm of hyperspace, where time and distance have no meaning.
It is like traveling across a narrow isthmus to pass from one ocean to another, rather than remaining at sea and circling a continent to accomplish the same distance. Great amounts of energy are required, of course, to enter this space within space, as some call it, and a great deal of ingenious calculation must be made to ensure re-entry into ordinary space-time at the proper point. The result of the expenditure of this energy and intelligence is that immense distances can be traversed in zero time. It is only the jump which makes interstellar travel possible. The jump we are about to make will take place in about 10 minutes. You will be warned. There is never more than some momentary minor discomfort. Therefore, I hope all of you will remain calm. Thank you. The ship lights went out altogether, and there were only the stars left. It seemed a long while before a crisp announcement filled the air momentarily. The jump will take place in exactly 1 minute. And then the same voice counted the seconds backwards. 50, 40, 30, 20, 10, 5, 3, 2, 1. It was as though there had been a momentary discontinuity in existence, a bump which joggled only the deep inside of a man's bones. In that immeasurable fraction of a second, 100 light years had passed, and the ship, which had been on the outskirts of the solar system, was now in the depths of interstellar space. Someone near Biren said shakily, "Look at the stars!" In a moment, the whisper had taken life through the large room and hissed itself across the tables. "The stars, see?" In that same immeasurable fraction of a second, the star view had changed radically. The center of the great galaxy, which stretched 30,000 light years from tip to tip, was closer now, and the stars had thickened in number. They spread across the black velvet vacuum in a fine powder, backdropping the occasional brightness of the nearby stars. Biren, against his will, remembered the beginning of a poem he himself had once written at the sentimental age of 19, on the occasion of his first spaceflight, the one that had first taken him to the Earth he was now leaving. His lips moved silently. "The stars, like dust, encircle me in living mists of light, and all of space I seem to see in one vast burst of sight." The lights went on then, and Biren's thoughts were snapped out of space as suddenly as they had entered it. He was in a space liner's salon again, with a dinner dragging to an end, and the hum of conversation rising to a prosaic level again. He glanced at his wristwatch, half looked away, then very slowly brought the wristwatch into focus again. He stared at it for a long minute. It was the wristwatch he had left in his bedroom that night. It had withstood the killing radiation of the bomb, and he had collected it with the rest of his belongings the next morning. How many times had he looked at it since then? How many times had he stared at it, taken mental note of the time, and no note at all of the other piece of information it shouted at him? For the plastic wristband was white, not blue. It was white. Slowly, the events of that night, all of them, fell into place. Strange how one fact could shake all the confusion out of them. He rose abruptly, murmuring, "Pardon me," under his breath. It was a breach of etiquette to leave before the captain, but that was a matter of small importance to him then. He hastened to his room, striding up the ramps rapidly rather than waiting for the non-gravity elevators. He locked the door behind him and looked quickly through the bathroom and the built-in closets. He had no real hope of catching anyone. What they had had to do, they must have done hours ago. Carefully, he went through his baggage. They had done a thorough job. With scarcely any sign to show that they had come and gone, they had carefully withdrawn his identification papers, a packet of letters from his father, and even his capsular introduction to Henrik of Rhodia. That was why they had moved him. It was neither the old room nor the new that they were interested in, merely the process of moving.
For nearly an hour, they must have legitimately by space, concerned themselves with his baggage and served their own purposes thereby. Biren sank down upon the double bed and thought furiously, but it didn't help. The trap had been perfect. Everything had been planned. Had it not been for the completely unpredictable chance of his leaving his wristwatch in the bedroom that night, he would not even now have realized how close-meshed the Tyranny's net through space was. There was a soft burr as his door signal sounded. "Come in," he said. It was the steward who said respectfully, "The captain wishes to know if there's anything he can do for you. You seemed ill as you left the table." "I'm all right," he said. How they watched him! And in that moment he knew that there was no escape, and that the ship was carrying him politely but surely to his death. Chapter 4. Free. Sandra Jonty met the other's eyes coldly. He said, "Gone, you say?" Rizzet passed a hand over his ruddy face. "Something is gone. I don't know its identity. It might have been the document we're after, certainly. All we know about it is that it had been dated somewhere in the 15th to 21st century of Earth's primitive calendar, and that it is dangerous." "Is there any definite reason to believe that the missing one is the document?" "Only circumstantial reasoning. It was guarded closely by the Earth government." "Discount that. An Earthman will treat any document relating to the pre-galactic past with veneration. It's their ridiculous worship of tradition. But this one was stolen, and yet they never announced the fact. Why do they guard an empty case?" "I can imagine they're doing that rather than finding themselves forced to admit that a holy relic has been stolen. Yet I cannot believe that young Farrell obtained it after all. I thought you had him under observation." The other smiled. "He didn't get it." "How do you know?" Jonty's agent quickly exploded his landmine. "Because the document has been gone 20 years. "What?" "It has not been seen for 20 years. "Then it can't be the right one. It was less than 6 months ago that the rancher learned of its existence. Then somebody else beat him to it by 19 and a half years. Jonty considered. He said, "It does not matter. It cannot matter." "Why so?" "Because I have been here on Earth for months. Before I came, it was easy to believe that there might be information of value on the planet. But consider now. When Earth was the only inhabited planet in the galaxy, it was a primitive place, militarily speaking. The only weapon they had ever invented worth mentioning was a crude and inefficient nuclear reaction bomb, for which they had not even developed a logical defense." He flung his arm outward in a delicate gesture to where the blue horizon gleamed at sickly radioactivity beyond the thick concrete of the room. He went on, "All this is placed in sharp focus for me as a temporary resident here. It is ridiculous to assume that it is possible to learn anything from a society at that level of military technology. It is always very fashionable to assume that there are lost arts and lost sciences, and that there are always these people who make a cult of primitivism and who make all sorts of ridiculous claims for the prehistoric civilizations on Earth." Rizzet said, "Yet the rancher was a wise man. He told us specifically that it was the most dangerous document he knew. You remember what he said? I can quote it. He said, 'The matter is death for the Tyranny, and death for us as well. But it would mean final life for the galaxy.' The rancher, like all human beings, can be wrong. Consider, sir, that we have no idea as to the nature of the document. It could, for instance, be somebody's laboratory notes, which had never been published. It might be something that could relate to a weapon the Earthman had never recognized as a weapon. Something which, on the face of it, might not be a weapon." "Nonsense. You are a military man and should know better. If there is one science into which man has probed continuously and successfully, it is that of military technology.
No potential weapon would remain unrealized for 10,000 years. I think, Rizzet, we will return to Lengani.
Rizzet shrugged. He was not convinced.
Nor a thousandfold was Jati. It had been stolen, and that was significant. It had been worth stealing. Anyone in the galaxy might have it now. Unwillingly, the thought came to him that the Tyranni might have it. The rancher had been most evasive on the matter. Even Jati himself had not been trusted sufficiently. The rancher had said it carried death. It could not be used without having it cut both ways. Jonti's lips clamped shut. The fool, and his idiotic hintings. And now the Tyranni had him. What if a man like Aratap were now in the possession of such a secret as this might be? Aratap, the one man, now that the rancher was gone, who remained unpredictable, the most dangerous Tyrannian of them all. Simak Aratap was a small man, a little bandy-legged, narrow-eyed fellow. He had the stumpy, thick-limbed appearance of the average Tyrannian. Yet though he faced an exceptionally large and well-muscled specimen of the subject worlds, he was completely self-possessed. He was the confident heir in the second generation of those who had left their windy, infertile worlds and sparked across the emptiness to capture and enchain the rich and populous planets of the nebula regions. His father had headed a squadron of small flitting ships that had struck and vanished, then struck again, and made scrap of the lumbering titanic ships that had opposed them. The worlds of the nebula had fought in the old fashion, but the Tyranni had learned a new one. Where the huge glittering vessels of the opposed navies attempted single combat, they found themselves flailing at emptiness and wasting their stores of energy. Instead, the Tyranni, abandoning power alone, stressed speed and cooperation, so that the opposed kingdoms toppled one after the other, singly, each waiting, half joyfully, at the discomfiture of its neighbors, fallaciously secure behind its steel-shipped ramparts, until its own turn came. But those wars were 50 years earlier. Now the nebular regions were satrapies that required merely the acts of occupation and taxation. Previously, there had been worlds to gain, Aratap thought wearily. And now there was little left to do but to contend with single men. He looked at the young man who faced him. He was quite a young man, a tall fellow with very good shoulders indeed, an absorbed, intent face with the hair of his head cut ridiculously short, in what was undoubtedly a collegiate affectation. In an unofficial sense, Aratap was sorry for him. He was obviously frightened. Biren did not recognize the feeling inside him as fright. If he had been asked to put a name to the emotion, he would have described it as tension. All his life he had known the Tyranni to be the overlords. His father, strong and vital though he was, unquestioned on his own estate, respectfully heard on others, was quiet and almost humble in the presence of the Tyranni. They came occasionally to Widimus on polite visits, with questions as to the annual tribute they called taxation. The rancher of Widimus was responsible for the collection and delivery of these funds on behalf of the planet Nephilus, and perfunctorily the Tyranni would check his books. The rancher himself would assist them out of their small vessels. They would sit at the head of the table at mealtimes, and they would be served first. When they spoke, all other conversation stopped instantly. As a child, he wondered that such small, ugly men should be so carefully handled, but he learned as he grew up that they were to his father what his father was to a cowhand. He even learned to speak softly to them himself and to address them as Excellency. He had learned so well that now that he faced one of the overlords, one of the Tyranni, he could feel himself shiver with tension. The ship, which he had considered his prison, became officially one on the day of landing upon Rhodia. They had signaled at his door, and two husky crewmen had entered and stood on either side of him.
the captain who followed, had said in a flat voice, "Baron Farrell, I take you into custody by the power vested in me as captain of this vessel, and hold you for questioning by the commissioner of the great king." The commissioner was this small Tyranian who sat before him now, seemingly abstracted and uninterested. The great king was the Khan of the Tyrani, who still lived in the legendary stone palace on the Tyranian's home planet. Biren looked furtively about him. He was not physically constrained in any way, but four guards in the slate blue of the Tyranian outer police flanked him, two and two. They were armed. A fifth, with a major's insignia, sat beside the commissioner's desk. The commissioner spoke to him for the first time. "As you may know," his voice was high-pitched, thin, "the old rancher of Widimus, your father, has been executed for treason." His faded eyes were fixed on Biren's. There seemed nothing beyond mildness in them. Biren remained stolid. It bothered him that he could do nothing. It would have been so much more satisfying to howl at them, to flail madly at them, but that would not make his father less dead. He thought he knew the reason for this initial statement. It was intended to break him down, to make him give himself away. Well, it wouldn't. He said evenly, "I am Biren Mullane of Earth. If you are questioning my identity, I would like to communicate with the terrestrial consul." "Ah, yes, but we are at a purely informal stage just now. You are Biren Mullane, you say, of Earth, and yet..." Aratap indicated the papers before him. "There are letters here which were written by Widimus to his son. There is a college registration receipt and tickets to commencement exercises made out to a Biren Farrell. They were found in your baggage." Biren felt desperate, but he did not let it show. "My baggage was searched illegally, so that I deny that those can be admitted as evidence." "We are not in a court of law, Mr. Farrell or Mullane. How do you explain them?" "If they were found in my baggage, they were placed there by someone else." The commissioner passed it by, and Biren felt amazed. His statements sounded so thin, so patently foolish. Yet the commissioner did not remark upon them, but only tapped the black capsule with his forefinger. "And this introduction to the director of Rhodia, also not yours?" "No, that is mine." Biren had planned that. The introduction did not mention his name. He said, "There is a plot to assassinate the director." He stopped, appalled. It sounded so completely unconvincing when he finally put the beginning of his carefully prepared speech into actual sound. Surely the commissioner was smiling cynically at him. But Aratap was not. He merely sighed a little and, with quick, practiced gestures, removed contact lenses from his eyes and placed them carefully in a glass of saline solution that stood on the desk before him. His naked eyeballs were a little watery. He said, "And you know of it, even back on Earth, 500 light years away. Our own police here on Rhodia have not heard of it." "The police are here. The plot is being developed on Earth." "I see. And are you their agent? Or are you going to warn Henrik against them?"
"The latter, of course."
"Indeed. And why do you intend to warn him?"
"For the substantial reward which I expect to get." Aratap smiled.
"That at least rings true and lends a certain truthful gloss to your previous statements. What are the details of the plot you speak of?"
"That is for the director only." A momentary hesitation, then a shrug.
"Very well. The Tyrani are not interested and do not concern themselves with local politics. We will arrange an interview between yourself and the director, and that will be our contribution to his safety. My men will hold you until your baggage can be collected, and then you will be free to go. Remove him."
The last was to the armed men who left with Biren. Aratap replaced his contact lenses, an action which removed instantly that look of vague incompetence their absence had seemed to induce. He said to the major who had remained,
"We will keep an eye, I think, on this young Farrell."
The officer nodded shortly. Good. For a moment I thought you might have been taken in. To me, his story was quite incoherent.
It was. It's just that which makes him maneuverable for the while.
All young fools who get their notions of interstellar intrigue from the video spy thrillers are easily handled. He is, of course, the son of the ex-rancher.
And now the major hesitated. Are you sure? It's a vague and unsatisfactory accusation we have against him.
You mean that it might be arranged evidence after all? For what purpose?
It could mean that he is a decoy, sacrificed to divert our attention from a real Biron Farrell, elsewhere.
No, improbably theatrical, that. Besides, we have a photo cube.
What? Of the boy?
Of the rancher's son. Would you like to see it?
I certainly would. Aratap lifted the paperweight upon his desk. It was a simple glass cube, 3 inches on each side, black and opaque. He said,
I meant to confront him with it if it had seemed best. It is a cute process, this one, Major. I don't know if you're acquainted with it. It's been developed recently among the inner worlds. Outwardly, it seems an ordinary photo cube, but when it is turned upside down, there is an automatic molecular rearrangement which renders it totally opaque. It is a pleasant conceit.
He turned the cube right side up. The opacity shimmered for a moment, then cleared slowly, like a black fog wisping and feathering before the wind. Aratap watched it calmly, hands folded across his chest. And then it was water clear, and a young face smiled brightly out of it, accurate and alive, trapped and solidified in mid-breath forever.
An item, said Aratap, in the ex-rancher's possessions. What do you think?
It is the young man, without question.
Yes.
The Tyranian official regarded the photocube thoughtfully.
You know, using this same process, I don't see why 6 photographs could not be taken in the same cube. It has 6 faces, and by resting the cube on each of them in turn, a series of new molecular orientations might be induced. 6 connected photographs, flowing one into another as you turned. A static phenomenon turned dynamic, and taking on new breadth and vision.
Major, it would be a new art form. A mounting enthusiasm had crept into his voice. But the silent major looked faintly scornful, and Aratap left his artistic reflections to say abruptly,
Then you will watch Farrell?
Certainly.
Watch Henrik as well.
Henrik?
Of course. It is the whole purpose of freeing the boy. I want some questions answered. Why is Farrell seeing Henrik? What is the connection between them?
The dead rancher did not play a lone hand. There must have been, a well-organized conspiracy behind them. And we have not yet located the workings of that conspiracy.
But surely Henrik could not be involved. He lacks the intelligence, even if he had the courage.
Granted, but it is just because he is half an idiot that he may serve them as a tool. If so, he represents a weakness in our scheme of things. We obviously cannot afford to neglect the possibility.
He gestured absently. The major saluted, turned on his heel and left.
Aratap sighed, thoughtfully turned the photo cube in his hand and watched the blackness wash back like a tide of ink. End of side 1. To continue, turn the cassette over.